Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we will take you to the Portland Public Library for an address entitled What's Gotten Into Us? A discussion about toxic chemicals in everyday life. The speaker is McKay Jenkins, a professor at the University of Delaware and author of several books, including What's Gotten Into Us? Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. He has written for Outside Magazine and The New Republic and holds a PhD in English from Princeton University. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Mike Beliveau, Executive Director of the Environmental Health Strategy Center.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased today to introduce to you McKay Jenkins. My name is Mike Beliveau. I direct the Environmental Health Strategy Center, which is a public health organization with offices in Portland and Bangor. I'm so pleased that and proud to have had our grassroots leaders featured in this book, and they have the work featured to have Maine's leadership be recognized nationally in this book. And let me just say a few things about McKay Jenkins and turn it over to him. He's been writing about people in the natural world for more than 25 years. McKay holds degrees from Amherst, Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, and has a PhD from Princeton in English. He's been a staff writer for the Atlanta Constitution. He's written for a number of magazines and other publications. He's currently a professor of English and the director of journalism at the University of Delaware, where he has won the Excellence in Teaching Award. He lives in Baltimore with his family, and we're here today because he is the author of a new book, one of several that he's written, which is called What's Gotten Into Us, Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. And it chronicles McKay's investigation into the myriad of synthetic chemicals that we encounter in our daily lives, in the products that surround us, in our homes, in the growing body of evidence about the harm that these chemicals pose to our health and to the environment. So let's please welcome McKay Jenkins.
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for coming out. Mike, that was a terrific introduction. I'm not sure what else there is to say, really. Maybe what I can do is show you a few images to go along with this and tell you the story of this book and how it came to be. And really, in addition to talking about the practical matters of the things that Mike was talking about, like what kinds of products you might be concerned about, it's very important to me as a writer to make sure you understand a little bit about the context and the history that led us to become so comfortable and so saturated with all these products that are made with all of these things. So I'll speak for maybe 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and then I'd be very happy to take some questions if you have. So the book is called What's Gotten Into Us, Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. And the book, the genesis for the book came about because about 6 years ago, I went in to see my physician with what I thought was some kind of a running injury. I was having some discomfort between my hip and my knee on my left side. And I run a lot, and I bicycle ride a lot, and I figured this is just, you know, the fact of becoming a 40-year-old aging athlete or something. Went in to see the orthopedist who recommended that I get an MRI, which I did, and late in the afternoon, about 4:59 on a Friday, the phone rang from an orthopedist who said, you have a suspicious mass in your abdomen and you need to call an oncologist right away. To say the least, this was not what I was expecting. At the time, I had two children. I still have two children, but at the time, they were a year and a half old and five. And it turns out that I had this tumor in my abdomen that was the size of a baseball. And the reason I was feeling discomfort is because this tumor was pushing on my femoral nerve, which is the big trunk line nerve that goes down your left leg. So as one does when one is given that prognosis, my wife and I freaked out for about a month, running around getting second opinions, all kinds of tests taken, this sort of thing. Ended up on the surgical schedule of a surgeon in New York City and went up to have an operation. About an hour before I went in, I was fully in my scrubs getting ready to go into the operation. Some researchers came up to me and said, do you mind if we ask you a few questions about your predicament? And I said, I was sitting there with headphones on listening to the Dalai Lama, you know, like trying to prepare myself for this momentous thing that was about to happen. I really didn't want to break that spell. You know, I knew I was about to get some good anesthesia, and I got the Dalai Lama and the whole thing. But I said, sure. And they had their clipboards out, and they started asking me about what they called my chemical exposures. And I said, you know, I've had two jobs in my life. I've been a newspaper reporter, and I've been a college professor. I've never worked in a chemical plant. I've never been mixing formaldehyde. The last chemistry class I took was in ninth grade. You know, what could I possibly have been exposed to? And they said, well, let us just keep asking you questions. And it turns out that the questions shifted from being about industrial waste kind of chemicals, like PCBs or something, that you might know there's some of them somewhere out there in a dump somewhere, to things like flame retardants in your mattress, or stain resistors in your carpeting, or Teflon chemicals in your cookware, or formaldehyde in your plywood. And the questions kept on coming and coming and coming. And what do you say to that? Geez, I didn't really know about all that so much. But by the way, I'm about to get my stomach cut open. Can I just like get back to the Dalai Lama? So they finished up their questions. I went in and had surgery, woke up a few hours later with my surgeon and my wife at the foot of my bed, smiling. And I said, that's a good sign. What happened? You know how it is when you're under and you pop, you don't know where you've been. I felt like a second that I'd been out for 3 hours or so. They said, well, we think that this tumor turns out may be benign after all. And I said, okay, that's good, I guess. What were the chances of that? And he said, well, we see about 100 of these things a year, and 4 are benign. So you drew the long straw this time, and lucky you. And so there I was, never had been sick, never in fact had cancer, just had this big thing cut out of me, and then was left with all these questions. And that's how this book got started. And the prologue of the book essentially tells that story. Like, where did all these questions come from? What did they lead me to think about? And they led me to think about all the things we're going to talk about today. So the book is broken into about 5 chapters. There's the prologue that tells that story. There's the first chapter where I come up and I talk to Mike and a whole bunch of folks who took part in this body burden study up here because, you know, logically as a writer, it would have made perfect sense for me to get myself tested. Having been through this, should I just get myself tested to see what kind of chemicals are in my body? But, you know, writers also have to live in the real world, which means like living with your wife. And I proposed this idea to my wife. She said, hell no, we're not going to go through that. We've just been through this. I don't want to find out that you've got 36 carcinogenic chemicals in your body now. She now knows, I probably do, as does she, and as do, sorry to say this, but most of you. But we'd rather not quantify that. Go find some other people who've done this. So I looked around. I could have gone to Oregon where they'd done this. I could have gone to Washington State where they'd done this, but I decided to come to Maine because I love Maine. My cousin Sheila lives here in Maine. My uncle Bill lives up on Mount Desert Island. Any chance I can have to come up here is a good chance. So I came up and interviewed a bunch of people and told the story that you've heard from Mike, this idea that you can test people and actually quantify quantities of synthetic toxic chemicals in people's bodies. Not out there in the environment, not in some waste dump, but in your body, in your tissue, in your blood, in your urine, in your hair. That's one chapter. Then there's a chapter where I invite a toxicologist to come into my house and walk room by room by room by room and just point out all the various things that could be problematic. And my house, to be honest, was reasonably clean in that kind of sense. I mean, I didn't have lots of air fresheners and things like that running around, but I did have like 8 years worth of half-empty paint cans and paint thinners and lacquers and varnishes and caulks and grout, all this stuff in my basement. We walked down in the basement, and the toxicologist said, my God, can you smell it? I mean, this is the top of the stairs. He said, can you smell that? I said, oh, yeah. You know, it was this kind of sweet, nasty smell, but I sort of thought, oh, that just must be my house or something. He said, this is really a problem. And we walked down there, and, you know how some people, like, they tell you something, and it opens your eyes, something you've been looking at your whole life. There it was. And he said, do you realize that this stuff is just, it's vaporizing straight up through the ceiling right into your kitchen. Did that ever occur to you? I'm like, no. So out that went. And by the way, if anybody's looking to get rid of this stuff, Craigslist, okay? Craigslist, I said free paint on Craigslist. I got 100 responses in like 30 minutes, and boom, all the carcinogenic stuff was somebody else's problem. So there's that chapter. Then there's a chapter where my wife and I take what I called a natural history tour of a big box store. Now, I won't tell you which one, but it begins with a W. And we went aisle by aisle and looked at products in every aisle and looked at what had labels on them and what didn't have labels on them. Products, just for example, that you can buy in the automotive section might have a label that'll say, "Warning, this product contains ingredients known to the state of California to cause cancer." And I said, thank God I'm in Maryland, you know, because... But you go across the store to the cosmetics aisle, and you pick up a product, and there's no label on it. But once you do a little research, you find out that that product has the same ingredients as the stuff in the automotive section. But because industry has a kind of a chokehold on government, which we'll get to later, they're not required to put a label on it. And it sort of defies sense, right? So why would you want to restrict or force a label on a product that you put on your engine and not a product that you put on your face? Right, so we'll talk about that in a little bit. Then there's a chapter called The Tap, where I want to explore the contaminants getting into drinking water. And for that chapter, I take a canoe ride down the beautiful Brandywine River in Pennsylvania and Delaware, which is the main source of drinking water for North Delaware, the city of Wilmington, and much of the area around my campus in Delaware. We take a canoe. This is kind of like a Dante trip, because we're canoeing down the beautiful Brandywine, looking at, you know, the beautiful, this is where a lot of the great American painters used to live, all the big mansions and the beautiful horse farms and all this. And then you pull out, and we then went into the water treatment plant in downtown Wilmington. So we literally followed the source of the drinking water from the river, where it is absorbing all the contaminants from mushroom farms and horse farms and chicken farms and, you know, the runoff from parking lots and all this kind of stuff, into the treatment plant where, I mean, tell me what you know about municipal water treatment. What do they do? What do they do well? What they do well is they dump a bunch of chlorine in the water and kill pathogens. You know, they kill cholera. They kill dysentery. That's really great. That was a problem in the 19th century. That's no longer a problem. What they can't take care of is things like synthetic fertilizers or pesticides or, you know, petrochemicals running off of highways or, dare I say it, the pharmaceutical drugs that people are taking and excreting in vast volumes, which they can, again, test for, and they can find, as the Associated Press did a few years ago, when they studied the municipal water supply in every major city in the United States, they found, you know, quantifiable amounts of Viagra in the drinking water of Los Angeles, which, you know, makes a kind of sense if you think about it. They found antipsychotic drugs in the drinking water in Philadelphia, which I don't know if any of you are football fans, but you know, my feelings, they ought to like up the dosage a little bit. So there's that chapter. Then the last chapter is called The Lawn, and that is a chronicle of the history of the American lawn and how it became the case that we all obsess about our lawns and want it to look like, you know, perfect, like a pool table. Now, I'm sure this isn't true in Maine where everybody's hip and enlightened, but, you know, down where I live, everybody wants a McMansion on 5 acres of grass, and they want to spray this piece of land till it's chemically sanitized. And I'll show you some slides in a minute about this, but I live in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, a beautiful place just like you have here in Maine, one of the great coastlines in the United States, and the Chesapeake Bay is being killed by runoff from all these synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, and we'll talk about that. So that's how the book is laid out. It's got lots of useful tips and all that, but for my purposes, the tip part, there's lots of handy-dandy websites and, you know, like recommendations that you buy stuff from Seventh Generation instead of Procter & Gamble or whatever you want to say. If you want all that information, that's kind of at the end of the book. But the rest of the book is trying to put all this stuff in context so you can think about, like, how is it that we got here? So that's what I'd like to talk about. So the story begins more or less with the downing of a ship in 1912. And you may think you know everything about the Titanic, but what you may not know is that there was no plastic on that boat in 1912. So we know this because when the marine archaeologists brought the boat up, they were surprised to find the fact that there were no things made out of petrochemicals. Now, if you think about it, it's only 30 years later that the Second World War happens, and we have this industrial explosion where now everything, I mean, you could just literally look around you and try to count the number of things that are not made out of petrochemicals. Count the things in your vision, your field of vision, that are made out of things like wood and cotton and wool or iron, and you won't get a very long list, right? This is 30 years later, so from 1912 to 1942, things started to change. So, anyway. I have to include something with Leo DiCaprio, just for, usually for my undergraduates when they... So as the 20th century moved along, we start to discover oil, right? And we now have lived, all of us have lived with this story for many years, lots and lots of oil. Petrochemicals, once they come out of the ground, they have to go someplace. And they do. We are all familiar with oil spills. We've seen lots of footage of this. But not all, despite what you might think, not all oil is spilled into the ocean. Some of it actually gets used to make our cars run, and it's a lot of the rest of it is used to make stuff. So it turns out that the United States makes or imports 27 trillion, that's a T, trillion pounds of chemicals, enough to fill 623,000 tanker trucks, each carrying 8,000 gallons from San Francisco to Washington and back. That's every day. U.S. chemical companies, $637 billion industry. They make 70,000 products, or the ingredients for them. I don't know if that sounds like a lot or a little, but again, just use your eyes. Go look around you a little bit and see what you can see. The problem is that a huge percentage of these products and the ingredients that go into them are virtually unregulated. This is what Mike has been talking about, and this is what Mike has been working on. Everything, it seems, is made of or wrapped in plastic. This is an image from the Hagley Museum in Delaware, which chronicles the history of DuPont and all the various things DuPont has made. Our food is wrapped in plastic. Our bodies are wrapped in plastic. If you could see images of the way women lined up around the block to buy nylon stockings when they were first released, as I say to my undergrads, it's like it was like what a Justin Bieber concert would be like now. Our homes are wrapped in plastic. You've probably seen images of paint covering the earth. This is somehow thought of as a good thing, like you would want to cover the earth with paint. Our faces, of course, are covered with all kinds of things. $60 billion is what the cosmetics industry is worth. There are 400 chemicals and counting in American cosmetics that are illegal in Europe. We're going to talk about that a little later. Our lawns, which, again, I don't know how much time you've spent thinking about the history of your lawn. This became, to me, an obsession for some reason. I became incredibly interested. I feel like the history of the lawn is the history of the United States, if you want to think about it, at least the history of the United States in the 20th century. So, you know, at what point did we decide that this was the ideal landscape? Well, again, like many things, you can trace it, at least its explosion, to the Second World War, in this case, the aftermath. So all the soldiers coming back from the Second World War, Levittown and all the Levittown imitators are built. Everyone gets a perfect little cookie-cutter house and a perfect little square of grass, and this is what the ideal becomes. So this is what it looked like back then. The trouble is to keep, as you know, to keep grass looking like that, you got to spray it. Now, this happens to be DDT, but this could be lots of other things. If you think about it, what does a lawn want to be when a lawn grows up? A lawn wants to be a forest. Thank you. See, I knew I was in Maine, right? Like, people in Maine, they know about forests. You know, other places are like, I don't know, a flower bed? So a lawn wants to be a forest. And how do you keep a lawn from becoming a forest? You got to kill everything else except grass. And the chemical companies figured out very quickly that if you can make the lawn the ideal, the monoculture lawn the ideal, you can sell people lots of herbicides to kill everything else, including, for example, clover. Right now, clover, I don't know how many of you remember this, maybe your grandparents remember, the clover used to be a really nice lawn plant because it's soft, you don't have to mow it too much. It's got the added advantage, we now know, of feeding bees. But clover is not grass, so the chemical companies figure out a way to create a product that'll kill all the clover, so all you have is that, you know, every single little blade of grass looks like this. What they didn't realize is that if you kill all the clover is a nitrogen fixer, right? It takes nitrogen out of the air and puts it in the ground. If you kill all the clover, now you have no nitrogen going in your soil, but they'd be happy to sell you some synthetic nitrogen. So now instead of selling you zero products, they're selling you two. And this is the problem in the Chesapeake, because this explosion of synthetic nitrogen fertilizers is what's creating all kinds of problems. So here, this is you know, the suburban ideal in every place but Maine. Right? This is the fantasy. You know, the chemical exposure for humans is one thing, but ecologically, 5 acres of grass is an ecological disaster, right? As a colleague of mine at the University of Delaware says, if you imagine yourself a songbird migrating up from Costa Rica and it's flying overhead, when you hear it, you know, singing in the morning, chances are it's just finished a 300-mile flight, and now it's looking down, desperate to eat, and it sees that, it's got nothing to eat. And it's, if you're one in your whole neighborhood that looks like that, they'll move on to your neighbors and eat there. But if everybody looks like that, they either go elsewhere or they don't come or they go extinct, right? So what you see in lots of places is crashing populations of songbirds. And one thought is that we've basically removed a massive percentage of their food supply because we've turned so much of their former foraging ground to lawn. And we now know this story, of course, is that, you know, as soon as you want a lawn, you've got armies of chemical trucks going up and down suburban streets all across America willing to spray your lawn for you. So since the Titanic went down, with no petrochemicals aboard, products made from synthetics are pretty much everywhere now. Now, in another context, you might think of an image of thousands and thousands of recycled plastic bottles as a good thing, right? You might say, see, recycling works. In my opinion, I've actually come to this conclusion recently. I'm beginning to think that recycling may actually be a bad thing. And the reason I say that is because when you have people thinking about recycling, that only encourages them to keep buying stuff. And when you look at the percentage of things like plastic bottles that actually get recycled, it's actually very low. A huge percentage of plastic bottles are not getting recycled. So the question would be, if you had no recycling and you were no longer allowed to make bottles like this, I mean, I guess the question is, what would be the optimal way of getting this stuff out of circulation? Is it recycling where only 10, 15, 20% of stuff gets recycled, the rest of it gets floating out on the, you know, the Pacific garbage patch, or what? It's a funny thing, and I think we're still evolving in our thinking about this. Trouble is, of course, is all these products end up washing down rivers, out into the oceans. You've probably heard about this so-called Pacific garbage patch where, you know, a sailor was able to go out into the Pacific and, you know, put a seining net into the water, and he was pulling up more plastic per volume of water than he was pulling up plankton, right? Because this is a swirl in the Pacific that goes around and around. He says people think it's like a drain, like the Pacific is like a toilet bowl, a giant toilet bowl. And he said, you know, that's actually the wrong metaphor. It's more like a bathtub that it never drains. It just goes around and around and around, and this stuff accumulates and accumulates. And you can find it, again, both visible and microscopic levels of this in all kinds of marine life. But the trouble is now, as we're beginning to see, scientists can find these synthetic man-made chemicals in every corner of the world, right? They can find them on the top of Aconcagua, the highest mountain in South America. They can find them in the bloodstream of Inuit people in the Arctic. They can find them in beluga whales in the St. Lawrence waterway that are developing breast cancer now. And you might think, how is that possible? There's no chemical plant in any of these places. Well, as we know from things like climate change, you know, it's not just ocean currents that swirl around the world. Wind currents do too. These chemicals, once made, once released, once disposed, they just circulate. So oil and synthetics don't just leak into the ocean, we're beginning to understand. We've all seen images like this, you know, birds covered in oil. We know that story. But we're beginning to understand that they also leak into us. And this is where these body burden studies come into play. And this is why I think they're the most promising, most effective political strategy to convince people that this is not an abstraction. This is not something that's happening in some distant place, in some cancer cluster in New Jersey or something, which is what most people think will happen, is those people down there will get sick, but not the rest of us. So 2001, the CDC starts to do these body burden studies. They're starting to do these in places like Maine, places like Oregon, places like Washington. I thought it'd be a fascinating situation if the President of the United States decided, gets up in front of the State of the Union crowd and says, you know what, I've decided to have myself tested for synthetic chemicals. And lo and behold, you wouldn't believe it, but I've got like 95 carcinogenic chemicals in the President's body right now. You know, I'm going to get the CIA on this to figure out how that happened, he might say. You know, if something like that, like you had Hannah Pingree do that here in Maine, what if you had a national figure do that? Better yet, what if you had the president's wife do that? Or even better, had the president's children do that? So you get, you know, a 14-year-old daughter of the president get up there and say, my body is full of 5 dozen carcinogenic chemicals. That would wake people up. And that is, in fact, happening. That, in fact, is in their bodies. But that would be a political statement of of great controversy, no doubt about it. So how many chemicals are in use today? Roughly 80,000. How many have been tested for, the full survey of health consequences? About 200, which looks like that. Where does it come from? Where does it go, all these chemicals? You know, as I mentioned before, chemicals labeled as carcinogenic in the hardware aisle are not labeled at all in the cosmetics aisle. Hannah Pingree and the folks up here made a big point of this, and I think it was a very effective strategy. They said the most politically viable group of people to talk about this are women of childbearing age. That's a mantra you'll hear. And the reason for that is that, I don't know anthropologically why this would be, but it turns out that women are actually concerned about more than just themselves. Especially as women start to imagine having kids or having kids, they start to read about this stuff and they say, gosh, it turns out you can transmit all these things through the placenta, through breast milk to your children. And that, you know, if they were cavalier about their own health, they are no longer cavalier when they're starting to think about their kids' health. So the idea up here in Maine, and I can tell you, living in Maryland is absolutely following Maine's lead on this, and other states are too. They're beginning to realize that women, especially young women, are should be the face of some of these issues. Today, 1 in 10 American families uses a commercial lawn care service, and 1 in 5 applies pesticides itself. Only 10% of pesticides have been adequately tested. Just for example, in one study in Denver, kids whose yards were treated with pesticides are 4 times more likely to develop soft tissue tumors than kids whose yards were not. Also, veterinarians, you may have heard this, veterinarians are often at the front end of this because they're starting to show an increase in tumors in dogs and cats, because dogs and cats, like kids, don't just walk across the grass, they roll around in it, getting much more, a higher percentage of their body exposed to this stuff. The total acreage of lawns in the United States these days is around 43 million acres. I've heard as high as 50 million acres. That's a lot. That's the size of Nebraska. Now, if you think about what it means to spray something that big, I mean, imagine spraying Portland, right? Or spraying, think about trying to spray 43 million acres. That's a lot of grass, a lot of pesticides. Runoff from suburban fertilizers and pesticides cause widespread damage to rivers and bays, both through pollution and algae blooms, which you've probably heard about, dead zones. I'm sure you have them up here. We have them like crazy. This is the Chesapeake Bay in August, where all this stuff rolls off into the rivers, into the bay. These fertilizers create these huge algae. They soak up all this fertilizer. They grow like crazy, and it all dies off. And as they die and decompose, it sucks all the oxygen out of the water. And if you took a camera and looked under this green slime at the surface of the water, you would find that there is nothing living, nothing, zero, underneath. Everything is dead because there's no oxygen. And that is because of two things, mainly the runoff of suburban lawns and the runoff in Maryland and Delaware from chicken farms. Because chicken manure, as I'm sure you know, is a very potent fertilizer. Pharmaceutical drugs, we talked about this. Antipsychotics, antidepressant hormone supplements, all finding their way into our drinking water supply. Of course, a lot of these things are also manufactured in China. This is a huge conversation that we may have time for. Most of what we're using these days is made in China, where it's even less regulated than it is here in the United States. There are drugs made in China that have been found to contain diethylene glycol, which is a component of antifreeze. A few years ago, you may have read that toys around the country were being recalled by the tens of millions because they'd been painted with lead paint in China. And we thought we'd figured out the whole lead paint story decades ago. And lo and behold, it's not just on windowsills. You know, now it's in stuff that little kids are putting in their mouths. Bisphenol A, we talked about this. Mike talked about this. This is a plastic used to make hard plastic water bottles. There's also another chemical called phthalates. You probably heard but probably can't spell phthalates, which is P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-S. You need a PhD in English to write a book like this, right? So you shouldn't be drinking out of this because the plastic from the water bottle itself, can be demonstrated to be leaking into the water. Now, the problem, that's all well and good if you're drinking, you know, room temperature tap water. The trouble with these baby bottles is that, you know, typically you wake up at 3 in the morning to heat up some milk for your baby, put it on the stove, heat the bottle up, and now the plastic, because it's hot, is leaking into the milk even faster. Flame retardants. This is a big thing here in Maine. Flame retardants in mattresses, in computer stuff, all kinds of things, in babies' pajamas, you name it. There's all kinds of flame retardants floating around out there. They accumulate in fat. They're fat soluble, and this is actually a very interesting thing. My wife is of Swedish descent, and Sweden, you know, Europe is way ahead of the United States, and Scandinavia is even further ahead than Europe. In Sweden, they learned about these flame retardants getting into women's breast tissue, and they said, that's all we need to hear. Flame retardants are dangerous, and we can find that they're showing up in women's bodies. We're banning them. And in 3 years, the levels of this chemical showing up in women's breast tissue drop by 30% in 3 years. Now, not so enlightened are we here in the United States, where they continue to be manufactured. It takes places like Maine to ban them, right? It's the feds are having a much harder time. Phthalates, there you go, phthalates. You guys in Maine inflated, what was it, like a 30-foot tall rubber duck to make this point when they were trying to get some of this stuff banned. You know, what these companies will say is, you know, we didn't manufacture rubber ducks to be put in a kid's mouth. You know, makes you wonder how many of them have kids. But you find phthalates also in weird things like detergents and air fresheners and lotions and all kinds of things. And again, like the phthalates is kind of the great mystery chemicals that you just find everywhere once you start looking. So what should we do? I'm going to do this fairly quickly. What should we do? The question is, to solve these problems, should we act as consumers? Or should we try to become more enlightened consumers? Or should we, you know, shake our fists and try to get some laws changed? This seems to be a big debate. I won't read all this, but in Europe, they have decided that chemicals are now, as of 2006, they are guilty until proven innocent, meaning if you want to release a new product or a new chemical, you have to prove that it is not dangerous before it gets out on the market. In the United States, it's the opposite. Chemicals are innocent until proven guilty. You release the stuff. If somebody can somehow prove that it's dangerous, somehow, and hire a good enough lawyer and the whole bit, then maybe we'll consider it. But as Mike said, in 35 years, they've banned 5 chemicals out of 80,000. So that's not a particularly promising history. Canada, way ahead of us, banning things like bisphenol A. In the United States, companies really are just not doing very much because they're not required to. The EPA will say things like, you know, we'll let you do it voluntarily. We'll let you, you know, regulate yourself, which, as we know from all kinds of other industries, is not an effective strategy. Mike mentioned that Senator Frank Lautenberg from New Jersey is once again reintroducing the Safe Chemicals Act. It's what the so-called TSCA, Toxic Substances Control Act, which is trying to get some of this chemical regulation done at a federal level. It's going to be a battle. I mean, it's much harder to get things passed in Washington than it is in a state capital because, you know, the power of industry is much more concentrated there. So states are doing great things. California, Washington State, Maine, Maryland is doing things. Lots of places are starting to do this, as they are with climate change. Like, the feds will do nothing, so the states are having to do it themselves. And you're starting to see some good success there. What should consumers do? So, you know, maybe you don't feel like being all politically active. Maybe you feel like going old school, like Granny here. Your grandmother didn't need synthetic chemicals, and neither do you. Rule of thumb, I kind of steal this from Michael Pollan, who you probably know about, writing about food. Apples are better than Twinkies is a good rule of thumb. So just as you should eat real food with ingredients you can recognize, so you should consider only buying things made from materials you can pronounce. So in the bedroom, you want to buy cotton sleepwear. It's actually virtually impossible to buy so-called pajamas that are not treated with flame retardants. Lo and behold, pajamas are not what you want to buy. What you want to buy is a cotton t-shirt, I suppose, if you want to put your kid to sleep. You want to buy laundry detergents made from plant ingredients. There are plenty of them. Seventh Generation, just down the road in Burlington, is, you know, famous for making these more benign products. And I had the great fortune of speaking to some folks here in Maine who said, I buy my laundry detergent from the woman down the road. And I said, now that's local economy, right? Not just buying, you know, apples from the person down the road, but why is it that people can't make laundry detergent and sell it locally? So one of the things that comes through in this question, there's a big anti kind of corporate message coming through here, because the vaster industry gets, the less control people have over the stuff that they're actually using. And there's a real urgency here to try to localize product manufacturing just the way we localized the production of food. Mattresses, you want to try to get mattresses, if you can, made out of wool, made out of natural latex. You can go to places like IKEA, because it's a Swedish company, and they will sell you a mattress that is not made with flame retardants. That would be a useful thing. Do a little bit of looking around, see what you can find. There are places to go. In the kitchen, instead of using Teflon, there's this newfangled thing, they call it olive oil. And, you know, you throw a little olive oil in there, and lo and behold, things don't stick. And it's like the good fat, you know. So it reduces your LDL or your HDL, I don't know what. But olive oil, good for you, right? Teflon, the people who manufacture Teflon in West Virginia, right? You think Maine has it bad, right? West Virginia is where everything bad happens, right? Because it's a very poor state. They'll do all the dirty work. They make Teflon down there. They successfully sued the company that makes Teflon for contaminating their drinking water and causing things like miscarriages. You can find periodically newspaper reports where someone will be in their kitchen cooking and they'll forget their fried egg to go answer the phone. They leave the thing on the stove too long. It starts to break down. And lo and behold, their exotic bird, the canary that's been singing for 5 years, is now dead. Because canaries, it's not just coal mines, right? Canaries are like seriously susceptible to Teflon chemicals. And they die like instantly when Teflon gets aerosolized. Who knew? You say, lucky I'm not a canary, right? Look for wood cabinetry if you can. You know, it is now possible to buy plywood that is not made with formaldehyde, but that's fairly new. When those poor people in New Orleans were ousted from their houses by Katrina, FEMA, in its wisdom, packed them all into these portable mobile homes, and lo and behold, they had been made with a really low grade of formaldehyde-infused plywood, and they were blowing like 6,000 times higher the EPA's recommended level of formaldehyde, and they had to kick them out of those trailers, so they kind of got it twice. Clean your kitchen, your bathroom, your laundry, your teeth, your hair, anything else that needs cleaning with products made out of plants rather than chlorine or other petrochemical toxic things. Drink water from the tap. You know, uninspiring as our tap water might be, it is at least regulated. This stuff is not regulated. This, as you've heard that story, I'm sure. Plus, tap water is not, in fact, absorbing the plastic from the bottle, which is another good thing. Living room, if you can use wall-to-wall carpeting. Wall-to-wall carpeting is almost uniformly treated with stain resistors. All this stuff that you're sitting on here has probably been treated with stain resistors and probably flame retardants and things. If you can find wool rugs, that's better than wall-to-wall. You want to avoid all kinds of synthetic furniture polishes, all the stuff that gets aerosolized. Anything that you're spraying, chances are, is not good for you. Buying toys made out of wood instead of petrochemicals and stuff is probably not a bad idea. There are a zillion websites in the back of the book where you can find safe places that will sell you safer toys and everything else, cosmetics and home furnishings, stuff like that. You want to avoid air fresheners. As my wife says, you know, if you want your house to smell like an apple pie, bacon apple pie, right? Imagine that. Go old school, right? Next time you're in a big box store, follow your nose. This is what I did. Follow your nose, and you will be overwhelmed usually with lavender. Right, the lavender seems to be the odor du jour, and it is coming out of the air fresheners, it's coming out of the fake potpourri, it's coming out of the pet aisle, it's coming out of the laundry detergent, it's coming from you from every direction, and that stuff is typically a neurological issue, among other things. So there you go. If you want your house to smell like an apple pie, bake an apple pie. If you use cosmetics, avoid products with no ingredient labels. Look for products that brag about their organic or at least plant-based ingredients. This is actually easier to find than many other industries because the cosmetics industry, because they cater to women, some of whom are getting hip to this, are actually buying plant-based cosmetics. It's a big growth industry, this alternative to the petrochemical stuff. Safecosmetics.org is a great place to look for this stuff. The basement and the garage, as I mentioned, get rid of all those old cans of paints and adhesives, caulks, lacquers, especially if they're inside your house. Your lawn, you know, if you use a lawn care service and they insist on using pesticides, find a different company. Some of you may know a guy named Paul Tukey who lives up the road here, has safelawns.org. It's a great kind of a national clearinghouse for organic lawn care. If you need a lawn, there's actually a way to treat a lawn. There's a whole nother idea, of course, which is the idea of tearing up some of the grass and planting it with native species. This is a big, big thing down in the mid-Atlantic where we've got all kinds of native plants going on, native plant societies, all this sort of thing. And suddenly, you know, what if the model, the aesthetic model for a suburban lawn was not 5 acres of pool table, but it was who's got the most monarch butterflies? Who's got the most goldfinches? Who's got the most hummingbirds? And in my neighborhood, I live on 1/8 of an acre. But when spring and summer rolls around, all the neighborhood kids are hanging out at my house because I got the hummingbirds. And you can believe that I'm self-righteous about that. So, you know, is this ugly? I mean, what's up with it? Like, Levittown says we don't want this, but we don't have to live in Levittown. No offense to Levittown. There's a great book, if you're interested, by actually a colleague of mine named Doug Tallamy called Bringing Nature Home, where he tells you in very easy steps how to, you know, cultivate native plants in your yard. And it's his theory is that if you took those 43 or 50 million acres of lawn and converted even a small percentage of them to native plants, you would have the biggest national park in the United States, and you wouldn't have to take any land out of its current use. You could create massive food supplies for all kinds of native species, and lo and behold, these bird populations would recover, and everybody would be happy. So he says, I'm buying it. I'm all over that. My 1/8 of an acre, man, I'm telling you, it is, you know, ecologically rich right now. So that's that. That's what the book is about, and I would be happy to take any questions if you have them. But thank you very much for listening. I'd be happy, there's some books over there, and I'd be happy to sign them if anybody likes one. And if anybody has any questions, there's a microphone right up here.
It's a portable plastic bottle. What about distilled water in polyethylene bottles?
As my understanding is that, yeah, so the question is, what is there a plastic, again, I'm going to generalize your question, is there a plastic out of which it's safer to drink than others? I think that polyethylene is a safer plastic than these soft, crinkly, phthalate-infused plastics or the hard plastic BPA bottles. If I can broaden that question, one of the concerns, you probably know this from the Nalgene company. So Nalgene was the face of the hard plastic drinking water. And all the hippies on college campuses for generations have been drinking, including yours truly, used to drink out of Nalgene bottles, only to find out later that they were all made with bisphenol A. Well, Nalgene, like, instantly got the message, and they stopped making these bottles out of bisphenol A. Of course, there is still a question. This is a rational question. So what are they making their bottles out of? And how do we know about that? I mean, there's a certain anxiety built into this question because we essentially have lost control over the things that we use every day. Some of you, I'm sure, in this room would know of a writer named Wendell Berry, a Kentucky farmer and essayist. And this is one of his ideas, that people have gotten so detached from the actual things that they use that they don't even know what they are anymore. We've become abstracted from our labor, we've become abstracted from our food, we've become abstracted from our landscape, we've become abstracted from everything. So if the question, if, you know, the 2012 question is, what kind of plastic should I drink out of? You see how, it, like, historically, in the historical context, that's a very surreal question to be asking. Because how long have we been drinking out of plastic? Not very long. Right? So that's a perfectly legitimate practical question. For my money, just because I'm a professor and I get to think big thoughts, you know, or sit around and think things that have no relevance, you know. My question would be, why don't we work towards, like, creating a water supply where you, I mean, imagine this, you could, like, walk down to the river and drink out of the river. Like, I know that's inconceivable. But, you know, there are people in the Chesapeake Bay area that are trying to legislate having the Chesapeake Bay swimmable and fishable by whatever it is, 2016 or something like that. And I'm thinking, like, how long, and for how long has the Chesapeake not been swimmable and fishable? Right? 50 years? 75 years? Out of the thousands and thousands of years that people have been swimming and fishing in that bay, we've, like, screwed it up so rapidly that now we think that there's no possible return. But that isn't true because, you know, the upside, the optimistic way to think about this is that these problems that we're talking about have only been around for actually a very short time. And it is conceivable with our big brains that we might figure out some way to untangle that somehow. Now, it's not going to be easy. And God knows, as Mike knows, every little tiptoe people want to make in that direction gets resisted in force by these industries that have so much at stake. But, you know, we're not all sheep, after all. Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I enjoyed the book very much, and thank you for putting out the message. I hope I can persuade you to add hand sanitizers to your list, and I bring it up, trivial as it may seem, because I'm surrounded by it. I sit down here. I happen to be one of the canaries, and if it's not triclosan, which we know is horrendously toxic, it's fragrance, which, of course, phthalates are used to make very long-lasting. There are a number of strategies that I'm sure you know about, and the Environmental Health Strategy Center has already started the message that the endocrine-disrupting chemicals are obesogens. They promote fat cell growth, and I'm wondering if you've thought about that and various other ways to prioritize beyond the plasticizers that you made the subject of the book. What comes next, and what are you going to be writing about in this line?
Thank you. Those are all excellent questions. Let me try to pick a couple of them. The question about hand sanitizers, I'm sure you've heard, there's, you know, we, for a period of time, were obsessively putting hand sanitizers on to prevent, you name it, bird flu or who knows what else. And then the research started to accumulate that hand sanitizers come with a downside, among others, the fact that we're killing all bacteria all over the place, so that our bodies are becoming more susceptible when they are exposed to bacteria to actually getting sick. And, you know, I have lots of friends from India, some of whom are doctors, and they say, you know, we grew up in India, and all kids just play in the dirt all the time, and nobody's allergic to anything, nobody gets sick. I mean, everyone's just eating dirt all during their childhood, and we come over here, and everybody's, like, perfectly sanitized, and everyone's getting sick. Like, what's the connection there? So I think that's a legitimate question. And the question I think you're implying is that the chemicals that are going into making this stuff, which we're slathering on ourselves all the time, is of unknown origin, like most other things. So you might want to consider thinking about that. The obesity question is one, I don't know if this is precisely what you mean, but I'll answer it this way. It brings up the question which inevitably gets brought up about organic food, which is who can afford to buy these products, right? Isn't this just another example of yuppies being able to buy themselves out of problems? And what are we going to do? You know, who's going to be able to afford $2 for a roll of seventh generation toilet paper or whatever it costs? It doesn't cost $2, but do you know what I mean? So how do you get the Walmart crowd on board with this stuff when all they care about is cheap? Right, because when you walk into, I mean, you walk into Whole Foods and you can buy loads of stuff that are all organic cotton, everything's groovy, you know, nobody's getting sick. And then you walk into Walmart where the mass of people are shopping, and they are buying stuff there because that's their option. That's what they want to buy. And so this is, again, where, I don't know if you guys are doing this in Maine, but there's a very interesting effort to get these corporations to see the market possibilities in shifting their line. So, you know, a few months ago, Walmart decided that they were going to sell no more products made with flame retardants. Now, Mike may know the answer to this. I actually don't know how that came to be. Like, who was it that finally, like, rang the bell at Walmart and said, the tide has turned and flame retardants are no longer something that you want to brag about? So, boom, they ban them, and suddenly Walmart, colossal Walmart, has no more flame retardants. Walmart decides to stock organic milk, organic yogurt, boom. Market shifter. It's like when McDonald's finally decides not to buy CAFO beef, that would be a miraculous shift. So the question, like when you're talking about how to change things, you can change them as a consumer, you can change them as a political activist of sorts, or you can change things by like putting pressure one way or another on these companies to just see the world, actually see the opportunities differently. Like if you propose to Maine potato farmers, look, you have a vested interest in lobbying for companies to buy plastic bottles made out of potatoes instead of out of petrochemicals. Suddenly you'd have a boom of an industry in a place that could use it. Right? That's a very effective, if you want to call it this, capitalist argument for shifting the way we do things. Nobody's saying that companies shouldn't be able to make money. It's just that they shouldn't be able to make money this way. They should be able to make money a different way and not have the collateral damage of all this health and environmental problems. Thank you for the questions. Okay, thank you very much, everybody. I'm glad you came out.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN. Today's speaker was McKay Jenkins, author of What's Gotten Into Us, Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. He recently spoke at the Portland Public Library. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with McKay Jenkins, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to this program again at your convenience by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.